This is Second Look. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's news director. Thanks for joining me for our roundup of local, regional, and state news from the week. You know, our Sunday afternoon show is usually an opportunity to catch a story from the previous week on WMRA that you might have missed. Well, today we're going to break that format a little bit and bring you a report from yesterday's events in Charlottesville. We'll also have a look at the 20-year history of the Stanton Music Festival and some tips on what to expect if you're going this week. And we'll hear from some of the voices from protesters who gathered for hearings over the question of water quality and the Atlantic Coast Pipeline. That was in Harrisonburg earlier in the week. That story plus a review of the week in Virginia politics with Jeff Shapiro, and we explore the celestial origins of the dog days of summer with our island universe. But first, three people died and about 35 were injured in and near Charlottesville yesterday in a day of violence that began with clashes at a white nationalist rally. One of those killed was 32-year-old Heather Heyer, who was hit by a car that plowed into peaceful marchers counter-protesting the alt-right marchers, neo-Nazis, and KKK members who descended on the city for their so-called Unite the Right rally. The driver of the car, James Alex Fields, is being held on charges including second-degree murder. Police say he is from Ohio. A short time after the violence erupted, a police helicopter crashed, killing two state troopers. Virginia State Police said the helicopter was assisting law enforcement officers monitoring the rally. According to the Associated Press, the officers killed were Lieutenant H.J. Cullen, 48, of Midlothian, and a trooper pilot, Burke M.M. Bates, age 40, of Clinton. WMRA's Marguerite Gallerini and Jordy Yeager both witnessed the car plunging into the crowd near the downtown mall yesterday. We will hear Jordy's report on events this weekend in Charlottesville beginning Monday on WMRA. Here is Marguerite's report.
On Saturday, following scenes of clashes in downtown Charlottesville between alt-right protesters and counter-protesters, the downtown mall had become quiet again. People were walking in the streets. A guitar player sang folk songs as police officers passed by, formed in a line. Two trumpet players were lifting up the mood, and even people dressed up as clowns, holding up signs reading Shame and Welcome Fool Convention. In the downtown area, it was only mainly counter-protesters demonstrating now. Then, people heard the loud noise of something hitting a speed bump and tires screeching on the road. Before long, people realized the car was intentionally driving into the counter-protesters' crowd gathered in 4th Street, in the narrow stretch between East Main Street and Water Street East. The car appeared out of nowhere at about 40 miles per hour, in a street where cars usually go at 5 miles per hour. It got stopped when it hit two cars in 4th Street, and it then reversed back up the street, still at full speed.
They saw the car right come down, and why the cops let the car come down there?
You saw the car when it backed up, man.
Yeah, I saw him back up.
Sorry, yeah! He just backed up and came across here, man.
They shouldn't even let him down here.
After about 10 minutes, the first signs of help arrived on the scene. A state police military van and car, and ambulances on Water Street. Michael Nigro, a photographer from Brooklyn, New York, for SIPA USA, was also a witness.
I saw the car come by, take the body of my camera off my phone and hit me, and then plowed into the protesters and ran over protesters, smashed into two cars at the base of the hill, reversed it, and then ran over people again coming backwards. The amount of force that was up there that could have caught that guy, watch for that. And it took the police and the medics to get here forever, but the street medics were performing CPR immediately.
One person was killed in this attack, a 32-year-old woman. According to the Associated Press, 19 people were injured. The driver was taken into custody, and Police Chief Al Thomas declared they treated the case as a criminal homicide investigation. Michael Nigro was critical of the alt-right, but also of the police.
You had today the alt-right that came armed to the teeth with their AR-15s, with their sidearms, with metal poles, with baseball bats, with tear gas, and pepper spray. The police let that happen. They let that go on. And when you were over at the park where the statue is, and to watch the police give way to let people attack each other was one of the more bizarre things I've ever seen in a protest. And I've been covering protests for years. They would come in and then give quarter. It was bizarre. Well, this happened about an hour prior to this terrorist attack.
After last month's KKK protest, several citizens had already come forward to complain to the city council about the police's handling of the event. For WMRA News, I am Marguerite Gallerini.
And please join us during Morning Edition tomorrow for more reporting on the events in Charlottesville. The Stanton Music Festival, now in its 20th year, is back for the middle of August. Musicians from around the world have descended on the town for a 10-day-long rethink of classical music. WMRA's Jesse Nadler spoke to the festival's founders about why this festival in little old Stanton has become a can't-miss event for music lovers from all over.
Karsten Schmidt's Stanton home has three harpsichords, three cellos, two forte pianos, and one Steinway. Here he is on the harpsichord. Schmidt is the founder and artistic director of the Stanton Music Festival, which hits 20 years old this month. The festival's longevity is still a bit of a shock to this German native because it started out as nothing more than a fun weekend for him and a few classical music-loving friends back in the late 90s.
There was really no budget. I think the budget was maybe $500 and most of it went towards beer.
My, how times have changed. The festival now draws 75 professional musicians from all over the country, all over the world, for 30 performances. A mix of traditional, think Beethoven, Brahms, and avant-garde over the course of the week. Some performances draw 500 to 600 people. And a reason the festival has grown so large, according to Schmidt, is that there is a level of spontaneity, of risk, that musicians don't really get to tap into at other venues. Musicians are brought in as individual performers, not as preformed ensembles. This can create visible suspense on stage.
The idea that you have four people play that piece that maybe have known each other for a while but have never played this piece together and they have 4 hours to put it together, you're going to get an experience. And most of the time, a really good one here, and sometimes an intense one for them. But it's really fun that way.
Executive Director Jason Stell points out another interesting feature.
An audience member might call and say, tell me who's performing this year, as if there's going to be a few household names that they might recognize from the classical or the musical world at large. And that just isn't what we do. We're not bringing in celebrities. We're bringing in the best performers who also work well with each other in a very tight, dynamic environment. And we pair them up in all sorts of interesting ways.
Schmidt makes a point of recontextualizing familiar works.
You sometimes have a piece that everybody knows very well. I'm thinking maybe Mozart's Eine kleine Nachtmusik or Vivaldi's Four Seasons. And then I think about what is a new context in which we can place this piece with pieces around it maybe that nobody knows to just shine a new light on these. So everybody thinks they know this. And all of a sudden, after you've heard something very different, that piece might sound like you've never heard it before. And that's always great when that happens.
Two to three performances are held each day in various locations downtown. Blackfriars Playhouse, Trinity Episcopal Church, late night performances at a bookshop and a wine store. Noon performances are free. And evening concerts run 2 hours and cost around $22 to $30 per ticket.
I have to make a huge compliment to the audiences, which is unbelievable, the kind of things we've thrown at them. We would have been run out of town in many other places, I have to say. And I do, you know, I do play in a lot of places, and many would not tolerate what happens here. And here, in fact, people seem to be coming for what's happening here.
Get ready, Stanton. The festival runs from August 11th through the 20th. For WMRA News, I'm Jesse Nadler.
And performances are going on through next Sunday, this afternoon. Peter and the Wolf at Trinity Episcopal Church in Stanton. That's beginning at 3:30 today. You'll find more information at WMRA.org. Last Monday evening, hundreds of concerned citizens flooded the Festival Conference Center on the JMU campus to voice their concerns at a Department of Environmental Quality hearing on water quality in the Atlantic Coast Pipeline. More than 120 signed up to speak. The DEQ has the power to deny the ACP from crossing or going through bodies of water under the Clean Water Act, but many at the hearing doubted whether the agency would uphold its mission to protect the state's waterways. Dominion Energy says the proposed natural gas pipeline set to cross Virginia from the mountains of West Virginia will create lots of jobs, provide much-needed domestic and clean-burning natural gas, and more. A small group of about 20 pipeline supporters gathered outside before the hearing to echo those sentiments. They faced about 150 other people there who disagreed in what turned out to be an at times lively protest and counter-protest. WMRA's Christopher Clymer-Kurtz filed this audio collage of the protests before the hearing.
My name is Flint Engelman. I'm from Charlottesville, Virginia. I'm a senior field director with Americans for Prosperity. The Atlantic Coast Pipeline will be a great asset to Virginia. It'll do so much. It'll help us with jobs. It'll also help reduce energy costs for Virginians and Virginia's families. So it'll help put some more back.
Jennifer Alt. I've come from Loudoun County, Leesburg, because I'm an environmentalist. I truly believe we should be living with respect and responsibility for the living planet. And here is the time for us to finally make the difference that all of mankind should have been making all along.
Bill Limpert, and this is my wife, Lynn Limpert. We'd have 3,000 feet of the damn thing coming right through the center of our property. It would lower our property values by $250,000. We'd be in the blast zone of the pipeline. This is a dangerous and unnecessary and unwanted intrusion on our private property rights and our freedom as Americans. And I'm really mad about it.
My name is Tim Brenneman. I'm here local. I'm from Harrisonburg. More jobs are available through energy conservation, as well as alternative energies in the solar and the wind sector. This pipeline is a waste.
Our ancestors and future generations.
Our ancestors and future generations.
And my brothers and sisters of all species.
And my brothers and sisters of all species.
Peace to all.
Peace to all.
A general discussion, a philosophical
discussion.
We're being
friends across the aisle.
Yeah, we're bridging the divide. I should tell you that I'm the organizer of the Northern Virginia Tea Party, and I've been that such since 2009.
That explains some of your political thoughts. Get that. It's
based on John Locke. Thank you very much.
Okay. And what was
I'm
your
a Lockean conservative.
I understand that. I do. Sandy Green, Mount Sydney. Okay. So go back to conservation easements. What is it that you as a citizen are buying by the...
Ron Wilcox. We don't have enough natural gas in Virginia. In the winters, when the temperature drops, the existing pipeline cannot generate enough energy to power all of the energy generation plants, and we have to switch to more expensive energy generating sources of fuel. And this will be helpful in creating a revival of jobs in Virginia, especially after the last 8 years of anti-energy policies.
Kay Ferguson, I'm from Charlottesville. Governor McAuliffe will be defined by this decision. He will either be the Democratic governor who sold half of his geographic constituency to fossil fuel, or he will be the Democratic governor who at the very last minute realized that this was a bad deal for Virginia and had the courage to stand up and say, you know what, we're going to take a little more time. I'm going to direct my Department of Environmental Quality to do its job carefully and slowly as it should do. We're not using a blanket permit, and we're going to slow this whole thing down. Pipeline's not about jobs. It's not about needed energy. It's not about keeping the lights on. It's about one thing. It's about profit.
And again, those voices collected by WMRA's Christopher Clymer Kurtz. Let's get a broader review now of the week in Virginia politics. Jeff Shapiro, political columnist with the Richmond Times-Dispatch, joined WCVE's Saraya Wintersmith for that discussion.
This week, the Virginia Historical Society was packed to capacity as the group commissioned to figure out the best way to contextualize the Confederate statues along Richmond's Monument Avenue held a meeting to hear from the public. Jeff, what's your take?
An incivil war of words, so to speak. The Stoney administration staged the first of two so-called conversations about the monuments along Monument Avenue, and specifically whether there should be fresh signage that offers, to borrow your word, context, and that most notably could include references to slavery, Jim Crow, and white supremacy. These are emotional issues, 150-plus years after the fact, but the crowd at VHS was sharply divided. The citywide discussion is a very important test for the city's new young African-American mayor. LeVar Stoney says he is fully committed to preserving those statues. He wants to simultaneously bow to the past but use the present to retell for the future the story of the Civil War and perhaps its uglier side.
Also this week, a pair of political polls show Democrats with a bit of an edge over Republicans.
Yes, a bit of a lead. Virginia Commonwealth University here in town and Quinnipiac University in Connecticut released polls this week. Both show Ralph Northam, the Democrat, ahead of the Republican Ed Gillespie for Virginia governor. VCU has Northam up by 5 percentage points, Quinnipiac by 6 percentage points. By the way, late last month, a poll by Monmouth University in New Jersey rated the Virginia race a dead heat. Now, the polls, and we really need to emphasize this, these are not predictors. They are statistical snapshots of the here and now. And Northam and Gillespie have different ways for dealing with this. Of course, they gush about the polls that show them ahead. They trash the polls that show them behind. The polls on which the candidates agree, if you will, seem to be those that show them neck and neck because those polls are particularly good for raising money. And both Gillespie and Northam have used that Monmouth University poll as a peg for cash.
And speaking of money, both of those men you just mentioned spent some on new political ads.
Ralph Northam has returned to the airwaves. He posted a biographical ad that emphasizes his career in medicine. This is an opportunity for him to not only talk about himself, but talk about health care, which is a big issue, especially after that big Republican fail on repealing and replacing Obamacare. Gillespie had been running three ads that were unanswered by Northam. He has now added two more spots. In one of them, he promises to rein in as governor the special interests in Richmond. And this might strike some folks as rather cheeky. After all, Gillespie was the consummate Washington insider. He made a vast fortune as a lobbyist and a communications guy for big dollar interests in D.C. Now, the other ad that Gillespie is running features a sheriff from Hampton Roads, from Pocosin. He talks up the Republican as tough on crime, especially law-breaking by illegal immigrants. This ad is clearly a twofer. It hits on safe streets and secure borders, both of which jazz up the Republican base.
And finally this week, the senior statesman of Virginia held a forum featuring lieutenant governor candidates Justin Fairfax, the Democrat, and Republican Virginia Senator Jill Vogel. The event featured questions from the audience, and Jeff, they weighed in on quite a few topics like guns, the local composite index, statue removal, and immunization exemptions for children.
And one topic they apparently did not discuss, Donald Trump, who has been a big topic, of course, in the gubernatorial election. In the debate, Fairfax went after Vogel for legislation that would make it tougher for women to have abortions. You may remember this legislation. This is a bill that in its earliest form would have required women to have an ultrasound exam before terminating a pregnancy. Vogel spent a lot of time talking about the McAuliffe administration and what it hasn't been doing, in her view, to strengthen the economy. She talked as well about bringing down taxes and reducing regulation.
Jeff Shapiro, our time is up. Always a pleasure speaking with you.
Pleasure is mine. Have a great weekend.
You as well.
I'm Chanel Varani, and this is Our Island Universe. As the calendar flips to August, here in the Northern Hemisphere, our days are long, lazy, and hot. Colloquially, we refer to these sultry days as the dog days of summer. Where does this saying come from? What is its connection to the stars? Sirius, in the constellation Canis Major, or the Big Dog, is the brightest star in our winter sky. Indeed, to our ancestors, seeing Orion the Hunter rise near east as the sun set near west was the signal that winter was approaching in the Northern Hemisphere. So almost 6 months later, when they would observe the sun and Sirius rising together near east, this indicated the arrival of the sweltering heat of late summer. Homer, in the Iliad, references the association of Orion's dog Sirius with oncoming heat, fevers, and evil in describing the approach of Achilles towards Troy. The Romans referred to this period as Dies Caniculares, the days of the dog star. To our ancestors, the sky was magical and full of patterns that they could decode but not explain. Today, we know that our changing sky has to do with Earth's orbit around the sun, an idea that would not be accepted until Galileo in the 17th century. I am Chanel Varani. Our Island Universe is a production of WMRA and JMU's John C. Wells Planetarium.
Support for WMRA's News and Information Fund, which makes our award-winning coverage possible, is provided by Bibb and Dolly Frazier, Les and Johnny Grady, Klein May Realty, Eugene Stoltzfus Architects, Joy Loving, Jenna Trettner, Nancy Barber, Pam and Jim Huggins, an anonymous donor, and by a grant from a donor-advised fund of the Community Foundation of Harrisonburg in Rockingham County. If you'd like to support our news coverage, go to WMRA.org, mouse over News, then click on News and Information Fund. All of our stories are archived at that website. And be sure to click like on Facebook at WMRA Public Radio and follow me on Twitter at WMRA News to get the latest on our coverage. And don't forget to keep up each morning with the WMRA Daily Hour new weekday early morning news podcast. Listen at WMRA.org and sign up for the podcast there and wherever you download podcasts. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's news director and morning edition host. I'll talk to you in the morning. Enjoy the rest of your Sunday.